Okay, welcome to the latest episode of Ubuntu Radio, and I've recorded in Raleigh, I've recorded at my house, other people's houses, and this is the first time I'm outside the country recording, and it's serendipity or kismet or, you know, forces aligning that today I'm in St. Vincent, in my hometown of Barrely, doing my Dare 360 soccer or football camps, and I've got to, of all things, renew my passport so I can get back to the United States next Thursday. It's Tuesday the 25th of July 2017. It's about 2:09 p.m. and I had to go see this gentleman in town who stamps the form so I can go to the passport office or the tomorrow. So we started chatting a bit. And he's somewhat of a historian. He's been in Barrely, where I am, the town where I was born, and lived for the first 9 years of my life. He's been here for a long time, and it became evident that he knows something about the history of this town and this part of St. Vincent. So, I mean, I immediately recognized the value in that and wanted to sit down and talk to him. The truth is, I'm not going to make it to the passport office this afternoon, so I might as well take the time to learn something and hopefully maybe educate anybody who, you know, is listening once this is posted about not only my town but my country and about the value of history. One of the things I wanted to do this summer was to talk to people, and I was looking for people to talk to, and I just happened to find this man, so I've got to take advantage of it. So without further ado, sir, can you introduce yourself, tell the people out there who you are?
My name is Frank Brench. I'm living in Barrely at the moment. Was not born here. I was born at Richmondville, one of the estates on the leeward side of the country. But I've lived in Barrely since I was 7 months old. Before the 19th century, we know, well, Barrely was part of St. Vincent and the Grenadines. And there are little snatches of history about the town. One is that it was named Prince's Town before it was named Barrely. As to who named it Barrely, we're not sure. I have not seen anything on the history. But it was here for, must have been here for a long time, because these hills didn't just go on yesterday.
Right.
Now, Barrely more or less lived off of the estates. Now, these estates were large landholdings by a lot of folks coming out of the United Kingdom. And the man who owned the lands in Barrely, the estates in Barrely, was a man by the name of Thomas MacGregor MacDonald. Barrely begins at a place called Monkwin. When you leave Leyo, you come up a place called Happy Hill. What is happy about that, I don't know. It's tall. When you get up there, you have to drink water, you're tired. But it's called Happy Hill, and then the estate begins there. That is called Monkwin. And after Monkwin, you have Petershope. Petershope was a place that I spent some time there myself. I had an uncle who was manager there. And there was a factory there. If you go there now, you'll find that there's a big, tall chimney to make molasses, because sugarcane was the main crop at that time. But there were times when they planted arrowroot and when they planted cotton.
I remember when I was growing up, I was born in Barrely in 76, and I could swear the old road, we used to pass tobacco fields on the right at Petershope. So I think at one, I want to say that's what it was when I was a youth. It was tobacco there, and I remember tobacco on the curtain fields, where the curtain football field now is.
And they had copper.
Okay.
The because he had a lot of coconut trees and he would roast the copper and so on. And we used to sell it to Dominica.
Okay.
He used to make soap and stuff and well, to make animal foods.
So for the people who might not be familiar with countries that have estates, are we basically saying like slave land, the people are working these lands for the estate holders? Or?
This is what the Americans call plantations.
Okay.
But the English call them estates.
So the same thing, more or less.
The same thing. Now, of course, when those estates were operating, trade unions were not known. So the owners, through their managers and their own workers, their own people who were in charge, they were the ones who ran the gangs. In those days, of course, you have, as I said, cotton, tobacco at one stage. Tobacco didn't last very long. They went down for a number of years until the owners got old and they sold out to some other buddy who had estate elsewhere. The estates went from owner to owner.
So would it be fair to say that everybody in Bali, for the time that you remember, was involved in working these lands?
Was employed.
Okay.
No matter what age.
Okay.
They're old people who you would think that they would have, you know, retired, and they could get a job selling cutting grass for the animals because they have, you know, the estates had horses.
Mm-hmm.
And so they have to go every day, and then everybody was employed in Bali. A lot of my own family were part and parcel of our. The estates here were Mount Crane, Peter Soap, Curtin. You see the flat there?
Mm-hmm.
That was Curtin.
And that was still one family, one man owned?
One man owned all that. And then you had Wallabo. And let them know that Wallabo was a place where Pirates of the Caribbean was filmed.
Where did these people live, these owners, this Mr. McDonald?
Each part of the estate had a what they call the owner's house.
Okay.
Peter Soap had one, Mount Twin had one. So he can leave Wallabo away. He spent a lot of time at Wallabo. But he had a Kingston house.
Mm-hmm.
So anybody go to Kingston, where the Prime Minister lives now,
mm-hmm.
was his house.
In a plantation, and bring cross one ship, blow the African. Now here comes the Thiefin Queen from England. Now she come on well and Henry Margaret. Send ship on top a century full of separation. And after 400 years, me send a reparation. I know them want to kill me with the tax.
When Mr. McDonald got Sinai, mm-hmm. he sold out all the estates to the Kiasan family.
What's the name?
Kiasan.
Okay.
Formerly Corey, and he changed it to Kiasan. They owned Anna's Vale estate. And then he bought out all the stuff from McDonald. So Kiasan's son lived in the house, McDonald's house.
So, I mean, I've always thought that. I mean, the history is the same in the United States. Basically, anybody who lived in the big house close to the estate owner or the master, when the master left, and the same is true in post-colonial countries in Africa, anybody who was close to the leaders got the land, got the money, and simply continued it. So all the names in St. Vincent, the careers and the people who own all this stuff in...
And the Ponettes and the Hadleys.
They were all close to... They had to be close to the estate owners. Or might have been illegitimate children, if you would.
I agree.
A lot of them.
Yeah, some of them.
So would you say that these people continuing to own... Basically, a lot of the stores and a lot of the wealth in St. Vincent is just a continuation of that process, or?
Well, one of the good things that happened is that the government bought out a lot of those lands. So the government owns all the lands from Mr. McDonald, because the estate eventually stopped operating.
This is close to independence or way before that?
Independence was in 1979.
Mm-hmm.
So it was before that.
The 50s, 60s,
yeah.
That far?
Yeah. When Mr. McDonald bought Petit Bordello, and I remember he called him on the phone in the afternoon and he said, Percy, I have just bought Pettibedale Estate, and now we own all the lands on the leeward side.
So one man.
One man owned from Moncton to
Richmond Vale.
Richmond Vale was really just on the Souffre.
Right.
So all, and these fellows used to come from Kingston to go and shoot wild cattle and wild
goats. So it was just their playground, the playground for one. So this was from when? To give people a sense.
Give an idea of that. This would be way in the 19th, what would be 19th century, late 19th century and early.
So we're talking 1900 to maybe the beginning of World War II, that there was this lifestyle where one man owned half of St. Vincent, basically.
No, there's one time when St. Vincent was owned by one single man, the Earl of Carlisle.
Do you remember stories, or do you remember what life was like for those people? Because in the States, I mean, we make the analogy that it was sort of slavery. If you worked on the estate, I mean, you're working on the plantations. But I guess the British have a way of changing words to make it not seem as harsh.
Yeah, yeah.
But are there stories about how harsh it was? I mean, we have stories up there about getting whipped for doing the least little thing. Are those stories the same here in St. Vincent?
Not like it would have been in America. Okay. But what would happen, you see, like I said, they didn't have trade unions in those days. So the manager, the owner of the place, through his managers, they operated. There were times when, we understand here in our area, the owner of the place, he rides the horses through the estate. If he meets a fella who's kind of leaning upon his hook, to get a breather.
Mm-hmm. So this is, okay, so this is the work tool. There are people who might, there are young people who might be listening who think, who have another definition of hoe. So we're talking about a work tool, a work tool on the farm. Okay.
And if this fellow's strong, say, just leaning on his own, getting a breather, they could dock his arms, his pitch. You get 14 shillings a fortnight. That was considered to be real good money.
So 14 shillings every 2 weeks.
Yeah. But some would get more, man. Like the what they call the supervisors, there was a name they called them. But say like they had uprisings and so on, not to my knowledge, in my growing up days.
Was it because the estate owners were that strict, the people were that beaten down, that they didn't think they could?
No, I think that the people just accepted, you know, the fact that they had a job and they're looking after the families. But of course, I don't believe we would have had much in the history if it was really bad. I mean, you know, people would have spoke.
Right.
But there's no indication at all that that people were really bruised, as it were. They went to work every day. What was true of, if I tell you that, to the best of my knowledge, we never had lazy people in Barrie. That was not an option. Laziness was not an option.
But is that a survival instinct? Is that because of, I mean, it's not flat. So we describe Barrie as a town that exists between two hills. You enter on a hill and you exit on a hill. And to gain flat arable land to plant, people still have to go way back in the mountains to do it. So is that a function of the lands, or the fact that you had estate owners who, if you were idle, just like in the States, if a slave was idle, he could be put to death because they needed slave workers. So sometimes I have this thing between, all right, people were idle, and I'm going, is it because of the Barrie is a tough place to live. Just walking around in the summertime for me is tough because you're going up and down hills. So you have to be fit. So it's the same sort of thing. But if I'm living in a community where one man owns everything and he needs me to work, I don't have a choice. I mean, in the States, I'm assuming, and I think I can remember if somebody black wasn't working for some white person, then there was something wrong with that person. They were labeled idle.
Yeah.
So that was their definition. I've always tried to figure out history in the context of when it happened. So is it we weren't idle, which is, it's always a good thing not to be idle. It's always a good thing to be industrious. But is it a function of the fact that there's one guy that owns everything and you have to work? Or is it just because we were naturally idle? I've always wondered that. And what's your take on that?
I think they own the lands. Mm. Some people own the lands. Some people used to lease a piece of land from the estate.
So like a sharecropper.
So he has a little sharecropper. But a lot of the lands, we have places up there that I used to go as a boy. It will take me to walk about four or five hours. But you go up there and you see all the lands walked. And some of these people didn't walk on the estates. Mm-hmm. They would just walk their land.
Gotcha.
You have a place called Mahute, you have a place called Param. When you're going down to Springbridge, there's a place called New Works. Then you have Bilan itself, people had lands there. You had lands at a place called Lali, which is at Wallamo, near to Wallamo here. And all of these places. Over here in Barry here, you had Lamy, you had Pierre Hughes. So all the arable lands walked.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the people never walked on the estate.
So they were still sort of free.
They were free to work.
They were free. So
because
not...
if you didn't have your own lands, you could lease a piece of land from the government, from the owner, and you can go and you can plant your potatoes, you can plant what you want.
So it was not as strict as American slave culture.
Just
make that distinction.
You could learn what you want. And there were some people who were just fishermen. They didn't work on the estate. You have fishermen. They go out every single day. The blackfish people, for instance, was a daily. You push on your blackfish boat, you go out there for 6 hours, and you spend the whole day out there, and you come back here and caught anything. And then sometimes you go out there and you might catch food. And that was the big industry, the town itself. Now, I am not quite sure that some of the modern historians or pseudo historians, they kind of bash the estate owners. But the fact that we didn't have trade unions only came in to St. Vincent with adult suffrage when trade unions began to flourish. Now we have all that, we have them all over the place.
So the vote took that long to go to St. Vincent in the 50s?
It took a long time before. Because in the 30s where I grew up, in the politics of the 30s, for instance, in Kingston we had a riot one day because the parliament increased the price of matches, either cigarettes or matches, but no big deal, no big thing. By a couple of cents. And people rioted, people got killed.
I remember reading about something like that.
In 1935, I was only 3 years
old. I remember reading something like that about, there was not an overseer, but somebody who was in charge of St. Vincent, but they didn't live in St. Vincent, lived in Grenada or something like that. And he came on a visit to St. Vincent, and the people who were, I think this is it, who were sort of planning this uprising, waited till he was here, and then they did that thing in Kingston, so they disrupted maybe like a governor general or somebody like that who was in Grenada. And they came here and they timed it.
The administrators who live, the governor general who live in Grenada.
Yeah, so I believe the story is, and it might have been some other thing, but when he came here, they planned it so that when he was here, I think somebody went to the court and petitioned about this issue. And then he was supposed to hear it, but he didn't hear it, so people felt some kind of way because he was here but didn't hear it, and then the riot happened in Bay Street in Kingston. A couple of people died. I don't think it was anything major.
I have not read anything, the increase in the price of, but a very small increase. But you know, the size of an increase.
Especially if you have a stove.
When things are kind of rough.
Especially if you don't have electricity in an oven and you have to, yeah. You need matches to eat. You need matches to light wood so you can cook and eat. Just to let people know, I'm on Ubuntu Radio talking to Mr. Branch, and we're just talking about the history of Barrie, the history of St. Vincent, about the estates, but what about the lives of the people themselves? So we say that, yes, people worked for the estate owners, but there were still people free to do fishing, to do blackfish, which is what St. Barrie is most known for. The estates were here, but that's not what we were known for. Even to this day, we're known for our fishing, and specifically our blackfish whale hunting. But what was the daily life? Is there any sense of what was the daily life like for like a plantation worker? Or an estate worker, sorry.
Sun gon' set here. Sun gon' set here.
thing with Obari people in those days was that they were good. They didn't just hang their heads and cry and say, well, oh, things are so hard. They really worked. My mother was Portuguese. She was not, you know. But my mother, I don't know if she learned that from her Negro. But, and those neighbors were, as I tell you, economists. They were disciplinarians. Judge Julian and children had. If there's any credit you can give to the mothers of Ireland in those days, was the fact that they brought up their children. Nobody, no child could, you couldn't suck your teeth in there. And then in the community, because the community was so close, although we had police, you work with the police.
Mm-hmm.
If you have this wayward pellet boy in your house that is not behaving well, take him to the police. The police give him a cane. You know,
corporal punishment.
Or you take him to the head teacher. Parents used to. My mother took my younger brother one time to the head teacher to have him flag. He didn't want to go to school today, and mommy took him up to there.
How many lashes?
Huh?
How many lashes
you got? He got about 2 or 3. Anytime you violated the rules, you come to school late. You get licks, you know. What I remember, many times I sit down on the porch by myself and I go over the years. It's the love we had for one another. I mean, and they were healthy. We didn't have disease in Barry, you know, all this diabetes and all this thing came in this last month. Diabetes and high blood pressure and stuff. That's the reason.
Well, because I think people lived an active lifestyle.
After a while, you see, in those days they were very active.
You had to, you had no choice.
And then you had to eat well. And there was vegetable. We were not using chemicals, we were not using fertilizers. All the fertilizer we used came from the cattle pen and the donkey pen. I could bring a basket of vegetables from the mountain and it will be in the house for 2 weeks and it's dead one spot. If you go to the market now in Kingstown, my wife does that every Friday, she goes there. And she buys sweet potatoes. And on Sunday, she cook and she will leave one. But by Monday, you put it in the fridge and by Monday, it's black inside. When I talk to people nowadays and they tell me the same thing. Like nowadays, food don't taste like food, you know. Somehow or the other, something is missing.
You were telling me earlier that your mother, your father, when they came back with 6 breadfruit from...
I came back with 6 breadfruit.
Well, you came back with 6 breadfruit. And your father would give away, your mother would give away 5.
Give me 5 neighbors. Because my mother will get up in the morning. She said, well, she wants to cook some. So she'd go to another neighbor here and get 2 tannins. Go to the next one and get a couple of bananas. And go somebody and get a couple of potatoes. And that's lunch.
So somebody like me studying that information objectively would say, well, the cohesion was there because I knew I couldn't do everything.
Everything on your own.
Right, I couldn't do everything. So if my field was banana, I'm gonna get the banana from my land. If my land was breadfruit, I'm gonna get the breadfruit. My neighbor, his might have been banana, so my breadfruit. So we had to, not had to, but it just made sense to help each other out because there would be a time in the future where I might need, so that neighbor is going to fill my need. I think in small communities, it just works naturally that way, where I can't do everything. It's impossible. We don't have the resources to do everything, so I have to rely on my neighbor. And then my neighbor is in the same boat. They can't do everything, so we sort of share the responsibility of a life. And I think that's what keeps the cohesion. And maybe today, people think they can do it all. Like, I'm guilty of that. I'm thinking I can do a lot because I have technology, I have easier fertilizers, it's not as, it's not as expensive, and I can do more by myself. And so I don't rely on my neighbor. Not that is anything wrong with that, because it's just a function of progress. If we progress, then I can do more. 50 years ago, I couldn't do more by myself. Right now, I can do more myself. I'm looking around your house, you've got internet access, you can see anything that you want all over the world. So you have access to more, and sometimes I think that gives people a sense of a connection, but it's not what you're describing. It's not the real, it's not the smell, it's not the feel, it's not that thing.
But you see what happened to every adult woman was another mother of yours. So if I leave bottom glass remaining and went up to and misbehaved, I will get a flogging from any one of those women. They'll flog me and send me home. If I go home and complain,
you get
my
another
mother
one.
Will give me a second helping.
Another one, yeah.
Yes. Every child had a mother in every different place. The discipline was such, from the police angle, you couldn't do this and you couldn't. You see, nowadays you see people walk in bareback. That was a crime against humanity in my day. Police will lock you for that.
But why? Sometimes I hear stuff like that, and I think in communities where there were estates or plantations and communities where colonial powers were around, the mothers had to take on, and it could be a cynical view.
Yeah.
I think the mothers had to take on the responsibility of mining and chaining, training the children,
yes.
Not so much to add something to their life, which they did anyway, but it was to protect them from the whims of the estate owners, because an estate owner could wake up on the wrong side of the bed and see somebody not dressing the way that he or she liked, and they could kill them. I'm not saying, maybe not in this country, because you make it sound like it was a little bit nicer, but I'm thinking the American plantation system. If a white man wakes up and some black child just wakes up on the wrong side of bed, and as just a youth, as just a child, they might not be feeling good. So they might, he says, good morning, and you might, he could get whipped, he could get killed. So the mother has to train the child. It's good morning every time you see somebody, because the child could die. The child could die, not for being disrespectful, but just being a child. So we were made to grow up and be proper. And again, this is my opinion. We were made to be proper, not because our mothers wanted us to be proper, because our mothers wanted us to live. Our mothers wanted us to live because, like I said, an estate owner, Mr. McDonald, could wake up on the wrong side of the bed one morning, and he sees somebody, like you said, leaning against his hoe or his rake, and the guy could have been just taking a 30-second break because of the sun, and all of a sudden he's dead or he's fired for no reason. So I truly believe in the end it's beneficial for everybody to learn discipline and how to dress right and act right, all that. But I sometimes wonder if the reasons are more sinister and more devious than we sort of give it credit. Our mothers wanted us to live. Our grandmothers wanted us to live in slavery times, in estate times, in post-colonial, well, right before independence. And I think they fostered that respect in us because they didn't want us to come home dead. The same thing happens with the police in America now, all these shootings. You're taught to respect the police and people die anyway. They're showing the police respect. They're running away from the police, you die. You're running towards the police, you die. You don't say anything, you die. You say something, you die. So our mothers tried the best they could to just do this thing. So sometimes I wonder about the respect thing in the Caribbean or in Africa or wherever. We want respect, and I understand that. But I sometimes wonder if it was more survival than just, you know, niceness and goodness. Niceness and goodness is great, but nice people don't get freedom. They don't. Nice people don't get justice. They rarely do. Sometimes you have to come at, sometimes you have to be rebellious. A lot of times you have to be combative. A lot of times, because the price of matches went up, you have to make your ass of yourself in order for the powers that be to go, maybe I should do something different. So I wonder about that sometimes. Respect, just for the sake of respect, is great. And it's something we can look back on in fondness and pine for it and hope for it. But I think sometimes it's a function of something else more sinister about power.
Say I love her, I and I preaching, so every land of hate will burn. I was
day when the ships came and chastised in a Jesus name. Wonder if me crazy, wonder if me sane, but the whole of Rome a go go up in a flame. I know nothing to me dark in a room and start a fire, start a fire. And I know nothing to me walk in a room and start a fire, start a fire. God, them a wonder how a little African I go burn down the whole in a Vatican. But I know nothing to me walk in a room, start a fire, start a fire.
Barry is the same size as it has always been, but we have more houses. The population nowadays was relatively small, so there was really no trouble, everybody knowing everybody mm-hmm. else. Nowadays, it's different because the changes. In our days, as well as a child, we had to go to Sunday school. When I wake up in the morning on Sundays, all over there, we have breakfast, then we go to sea. Lunchtime, we come out of sea, and then we get some treats, and then mother say, go and get a nap, 3 o'clock, put on your clothes at Sunday school. There's no, the spiritual life of Barry has been off.
Start a fire, yes. No nothing for me walk in a room and start a fire. Me say a fire because them a ask how a little African now go ignite the whole in a Vatican. But I know nothing for me walk in a room. Start a fire.
In those days, you had the Methodists, you had the Anglicans, and later on the Adventists came in, Baptists came in, the Christian truth people were here from long, long time. I went to Sunday school when I was 3 and had to do that. But the funny thing about me, when I come out of the sea at 12 o'clock time and at lunch time, I had to carry lunch to 3 different people before I can sit down and eat mine. Because my mother used to make lunch and standards for 3 old folk. So I had to carry them. They were all living in bamboos.
Were they old family members or just old people that she liked?
There were some of them who had families. That doesn't matter. No matter what you had, people who were kind, morally, Barry is not like what it was in our days. Although they have so many different churches. A lot of the parents are very careless. Do you know that we have George and Barry 12 years of
work? I see.
We had babies.
I see. I've been here, again, coming back to do my camp since summer 2009, and I bring a gentleman with me. And the first night we were here, we walked from my father's house on Glebe to where we stayed, my mother's house in Curtin. And I just watched him, and then when we got to my mother's house, I asked him, what did you see? One of the first things he noticed was that 13, 14-year-old girls carrying some little kid on their hip. So it's an epidemic, but I think, and again, one of the reasons I want to talk to people is my opinion is that in these societies, for example, if I'm a 13-year-old girl or 14-year-old girl, not to justify promiscuity, but I want something. In America, like I get a 16-year-old boy, he can drive. So that means if I want to go have some fun, we can both go somewhere and have some fun. What 16-year-old boy in St. Vincent is going to impress another 16-year-old girl? Well, let's go down to the wharf and speak.
Yeah.
But a nice man who's 30, who's established, who has a government job, has a car, and all of a sudden he comes around and he looks like he has more and he has better, and I'm a 16-year-old girl and I want to have some fun. Well, the people that can offer me the fun is somebody older, somebody with money and power. And I'm not saying that they're not having unprotected sex with people their own age, because one of the kids at camp, 18, 19 years old, he just became a father 3 months ago. And I was kind of surprised, but you know, I think he's going to be a good father. But I think it's also, again, goes back to power. I think people in power. And you'd mentioned this earlier before we began speaking, that like back in your history, a plantation or an estate owner had somebody who was working, a family member who was working for them, and all of a sudden 9 months later your family tree changes.
Yeah.
And that has nothing to do with probably the woman. It has everything to do with an older man saying, either you do this or you lose your job.
Yeah.
You know? So I think that mentality still exists. But it's not the white colonial power, it's not the whoever, it's just somebody with money and power. And it's not just in St. Vincent's anywhere, it's anywhere in the world, but it's an epidemic here because of poverty, because of things like that. And I mean, like one of the things you addressed earlier was religion and why people don't value or fear. I think it's fear. religion the way they used to. And I think it's the same way all over the world. People don't fear the unknown because science has told us that.
Tell them something else.
There's an answer. All these things. Well, why does the volcano rumble? Well, God is angry. No, the volcano rumbles because there are plates in the earth, and every now and again they act up, and this happens. So, for example, you said, you know, like at the church, you don't see a lot of young people going there. And I was surprised when he said that, because when I was growing up here in the early 80s, like we went to the Anglican church, and I went to morning service. And then I had to go to Sunday school, and I had to go to children's Bible, whatever it is, in the afternoon. So, but you said in your day, the kids sort of went to the beach, and then I guess they didn't go to the adult service, and then they went to the
Sunday school
in the afternoon. But I remember I had to do both. Actually, one of my biggest joys in life when I was 6, 7 years old was to ring that bell.
Ring the bell.
Ring the bell to call people into Sunday service. But I fear religion. My first ambition in life, Mr. Branch, was to be a pastor in the Anglican Church. And we mentioned all the different denominations that are here. I went to Seventh-day Adventist school when I first started school, so I did Seventh-day Adventist. I remember I had a friend, Hanif, who lived in Middle Street. He took me to Grace and Truth, and I was at Grace and Truth for a while. I think there was a Pentecostal church on the way up to Curtin on the left.
Curtin, yes, there was.
I remember going to the
one on the left up on the hill is
a blue wall. I just remember a blue wall.
They never have it. Really good, very good place.
The big church that I never went to, might have been once or twice for a funeral, was the Methodist Church right by Goose. I don't remember ever going there. I was always going to the Anglican church, and I was always fearful of God because the Seventh-day Adventists, I remember they said that when I was younger, you should not look at the sky for fear that you would see the face of God, and if you see the face of God, you die. So as a child, as a 5, 6-year-old, I never looked at the sky. I never looked at the sunset. I never looked because I was scared out of my mind. I bring that up to get back to your point about religion. Well, we don't fear this generation, my generation, the generation subsequent to mine. We don't fear that because we know that a lot of that stuff is not true. I think, call it whatever we want, God, Allah, whatever. But I think at the end of the day, it's healthy to have respect, maybe not fear. I don't believe in fearing God. I believe in respecting something beyond you. Like, you're not here by your own volition. I am not here because I made myself. I'm here for some other reason. And I'm part of a process. My mother had me, her mother had her. So I'm a continuation of something that started, I don't know when, Big Bang or God breathing life into Adam and Eve. I don't know, but I respect the fact that I am not alone here. And so when you talk about the community, I would respect my mother, and if she respects my neighbor, I would respect my neighbor because we're all part of a lineage. You know, in the Old Testament, such and such begets such and such, and begets such and such, and begets. Even though I'm not sort of a Bible-thumping person, I believe in the principles of that, in the connection and the connectivity, basically saying, if such and such begets such and such, and begets such and such, then if I follow that reasoning and that line, I can go all the way back to Abraham and Isaac, you know what I'm saying?
That's where we came from.
So I can go all the way back, and that's a powerful
thing. The human race is really one race.
That's a powerful, powerful thing when we believe it.
God, show me the way because the devil trying to break me down.
The trouble with this teenager's getting pregnant, a 16-year-old girl in Barry now, living with her mother, could very well 5 stepfathers come to the house.
So it's normal.
You understand? It's like a normal thing now. And it's these stepfathers that are doing a lot of damage to these young girls.
Right.
In some cases, their mothers actually sell their daughters to their stepfathers. I sat as a juror one time when the mother had sold the daughter to the stepfather.
She got here in Timbuktu.
Yeah. We brought him guilty. There was enough evidence that he went to jail. And I have always said when I repeat that case, I would have called in the mother to her and I'd have sent her and I'd ask her to put her in a cell and give me the key, let me keep.
In Fox Puerto Rico, there was family. With more confusion, take it from me. There was a mama and a papa with one child alone, who wanted to be married and have a wife of his own. So he went to the papa. The papa said, no, that girl is your sister, but your mama don't know.
Why is me? A shame and scandal in the family.
It's chronic in St. Vincent, the state of Indigenous. People don't get married nowadays, like in our days. I can remember seeing people in the days when Wednesday was the half day. Wednesday was wedding day. You know,
I never thought about that.
Wednesday was wedding day mostly.
So most people got married on Wednesday.
Wednesday afternoon.
I never thought about that.
Yeah. Nowadays, of course, Saturday is the half day. You can get Saturday, get married on Saturday. Well, yeah, I think you're going to get married on Sundays nowadays because these churches have their own service.
So in St. Vincent, the British named the word, so I never thought about that. Wednesday was wedding day.
Well, what's the condition of wedding day? That's where people get married.
I never thought about that.
And I remember sitting, you're in the road, they want people getting married, you know, it's a spectacle, so you're there, and you see them, the man and the woman coming down, their hands hooked together. And then they walk down the road and they go to where they keep it up to reception. Sometimes, I remember one particular fellow from Bottom Glass, they found it crying. He walked a woman right from the back and had a wedding cake on a tree.
Wow.
Yeah.
What else, when you were growing up, was like a fun spectacle, something fun like that that you remember that people just don't do anymore?
Tons of them.
So give me a couple.
Number one, we had the sports. We still have sports today, but not like in the old days. We have a team of cricketers come from Rosebank, or from up the countryside. It will be a big day in Maryland. They cook up a whole set of, they cook a whole. And we had club ladies. I don't know if it's in your days, they had club ladies. So when a fella gets out, club ladies have to go and bring him off the field, and then when time come to eat, they go and they have this. It was a real gala stuff. And everybody's involved. Everybody's involved. And in those days, in cricket, you know, if a fella, one particular team from Rosebank, if one of the fielders drop a ball, the captain will hit him over his head with his belt.
What?
We'll punish him for dropping the ball.
What?
And everybody in Barney would come out at those things. We used to have rounders, what we call rounders, which is your baseball, like your baseball. You hit the ball with your hand, you know, and you run around and so on. Rounders was a very popular. And then we had maypole stuff.
What is that?
In May, where you have... The maypole, because you have maypole in America.
It's an older thing.
You have a bunch of girls and they have ribbons coming from the pole.
They're
skipping, you know. That used to be popular. We used to get people coming from the countryside, busloads. I mean, like coming to Bali, like tourists. And they come down and so on. We had people coming from Fakil, our family. We used to come there and spend the day in the town and spend the day with us and eat.
So at one point, Barley was one of the first European capitals in the Caribbean. I think I read something like that. If not the European capitals in the Caribbean, the first British capital. Like Barley was established as one of the first capital cities by a colonial power in the Caribbean. I think that's true.
And that is when it was Prince's time.
So then would Barley be obviously Kingstown, because that's the administrative center of St. Vincent. Then would Barley be the second most important town? If people are coming from places.
At one stage.
Blow, 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 'cause we love you now.
sometimes I say, St. Vincent is too small. Well, they tell me that we got 110,000 people in St. Vincent.
I don't think that's right.
I laugh at that.
Because I've been seeing that number since 1986, and I look around in Barley, and it's three times as many kids.
And you take the Rastafellas up in the air, in the field, so they think we'll come down here and answer questions at census.
So your number, what is your number? Because I don't believe in that 110 to 120,000.
My number is 125,000. That's as far as I would.
I'd go bigger. Somebody told me that there are 5,000 registered...
How much?
5,900 or something like that registered voters, yes, in Barrie.
In Barrie. But then you can imagine the number of children.
Children and all that stuff.
Under 14. Because if you want to see children in Barrie, it's a great address school to do. Unless it's just for one school.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I fear for the children, man. The children and the young people. Well, the young fellows who have left school on Sunday, they will have to fend for themselves. But I'm really concerned about ones who are still in school, secondary school. You know. I don't know how we're ever going to get agriculture to really be like it was in the old days.
I don't think it ever will, unless in any part of the world, it's not going back.
Never will.
I mean, part of it, your concern is valid, but it's also the truth all over the world is that low-level manufacturing jobs don't exist. And the ones that do exist are in countries, unfortunately, that are poorer, if we can think about it, than St. Vincent, where they can be exploited. Like the banana industry died in St. Vincent when markets opened up in the 90s, and instead of England buying bananas for 10 cents here, they can get it for 2 cents in Thailand. So it makes no economic sense for them to come here. But I think one of the things that and again, it's happening all over the world, the loss of manufacturing, low-level jobs, unskilled labor. And those things go to where there's less taxes for the companies, less cost for them. So it's more efficient, more economical. But I think one of the things, for example, I was talking to a gentleman, is Wickham in Curtin Hill. He makes sandals. He makes all leather goods.
Oh, that's the wife. That's the husband of my first cousin, I told you.
So Wickham is over there and he's making sandals. Well, he's got to get leather. Leather's it's expensive. And it's about getting a mass quantity
of leather
to do what he needs to do. And that's not very cost effective. So then his prices are up. And he's in Curtin, so he sells to the tourists, I'm assuming. And not so much to the local people, I guess, who can't afford it. So the price point is too high. But then if he can get a mass quantity of leather in, then he can... Its prices can go down, which means he can, in the end, probably make more money. But I think, for example, you talk about, I remember people like this at the community center. They would be making baskets and things like that.
Right.
And then I never knew where it went, but it could have been St. Lucia or New Zealand or somewhere. But so there are businesses here, like this leather guy, Mr. Wickham. But what he's got to start doing, and it's free. You can go on the internet, make your own shop, and just sell it directly to people. And I think that's the point where we're at now. I think we have a history of relying on somebody else to make what we do in St. Vincent known. Like somebody, like a white pastor, has to do it and sell it to the people that he knows in New Zealand. Well, we don't need him anymore. We don't need him. We need to do what we do. Know how to do well. Like, there's no reason Barrie cannot be a tourist destination. There's no reason.
Gosh,
why are we waiting for the government to tell people in Barrie what we know, what will work, or what will be interesting about our town to anybody in the world? If we have a history of blackfish hunting, then we need to manufacture our blackfish stories to people in Norway and Japan that have the same history and culture, because they'll want to come here because there's a kinship in terms of what we do. There's a community in Japan right now who's probably got the same history, maybe not exactly the same, but you understand what I'm saying. Their old men can come and tell the same stories to our old men. It's all blackfish hunting, whaling stories. Yeah. So those communities existed. Norway, in northern Canada, in Japan, but it's just about us then connecting, like you said before, making a connection. And now, connections are not just neighbor to neighbor and barely. Connections now are to somebody in Japan, somebody in Norway because of the internet and because of the access to information. So I think it's us recognizing what we can, like you stating earlier, you recognize that there's a certain pride in the way we live in this community. Yeah. There's a certain way barely people behave and act.
Yeah.
Well, we need to kind of rediscover what that is. And that is not just about spreading that in St. Vincent, but then we can spread that anywhere. And we don't understand that people will pay to come here and be a part of that. They will pay to do it.
Well, in the days when we had tone boards, when Reggie was a tone board man.
And that's my grandfather.
When Reggie was a tone board man, and other of the prominent people, barely. Nowadays, we don't have a tone board. They call it, I told them on the radio, they said, don't use the word tone board, it is not a tone board. There's one woman up there in the building who runs the town. One person, even the police. I don't know about other communities, I can't talk about that. This community here is not well policed. I don't know, you were nine when you went up to...
I was here from 76 to 85.
85, okay.
So the police was still important, and the police was still feared. Like, if you go by the police station, that was a big deal.
The police were there. In my day, every time you turn around in the road, the policeman was behind you. We couldn't go and walk and jump out there. That was prohibited.
Why?
Policeman say, don't go and hurt yourself. Don't go over there and jump out the avenue. You couldn't do that. The town was clean. Nowadays, littering in Barley, littering, obscene language, it's a trinity. I always talk about it, trinity, obscene language. Oh, noise. Mm-hmm. Noise. There's a noise act. We couldn't say anything. If you and I are friends,
mm-hmm.
and we're going walking on the road, and you said something, and I say, why don't you shut up? That was a crime against humanity. If you couldn't tell somebody shut up, and we couldn't say, hey, you tell somebody go to hell and so on, they, any big person would have heard that, you would have been flogged. I ask the Lord when I pray, Lord, if we can get the people together to make the world a better place for children. You know, children growing up in a very crude and hostile environment. Parents batter them. They're battered by neighbors. They're doing all kinds of things like that. So I'm at the gate standing up, you know, just looking. And you see the young girls coming up. They have one child in their arm, and they have one holding on.
Right. They're
scared. I don't know. And how much... Do they really, you know, how do they get by? I really don't. And not to say there's a place where you can get employment like that, so not in Berkeley. Is there no other option than adoption for your babies? You're ruffling and jacketing and auctioning your babies. Strength of Rastafari, I am hoping someday maybe they don't obey their parents, maybe they will obey me. Cowards play the game thing, fathers do the brave thing, and that's participating. Well, some people are fortunate. Parents go overseas, spend some years, and they're able to get to stay. At one stage, they told us there were enough people in New York from St. Vincent. You could have your own political party.
Right, I'm told there are more Vincentians living abroad than there are here.
Yeah, for a long time.
There's more than...
Even in Trinidad,
yeah.
There was one, I'm sure it happened from the other, but from Barley, there was a year when young fellas were going to Trinidad like it was going out of fashion. And some of them never ever came back. When you did hear from them, they died.
Gotcha.
I had neighbors, they used to see everything they were going to see. We go play cricket, we go to Nagulu, play young fruit and all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, I think there are people, I think, on the Doyle end of my family that are Trinidadians that I have no idea about.
Yeah.
Or they went there, and like you said, they never came
back. And Bobby, that's true. Right. Well, and then there was a Taiwan, and then went to Aruba, remember? The Aruba days. Your cousin, Kenneth. Don't even know Kenneth.
I have an uncle, Kenneth.
Uncle Kenneth.
I have an uncle, Kenneth. Uncle Rudy.
That's my good buddy. Kenneth is my good buddy, man.
When I put this on the air, online, I'm going to make sure I send a link so you can listen.
Yeah.
So you can listen to you.
Good. Because while I didn't know him in Berkeley, I knew him in Kingston. And when I knew who his people were, you know. And these are the kind of people you really like to be around.
It's incredible. You talk about being industrious. Michael Kenneth, he seemed like he's a mechanical whiz. He's a very eclectic person because I know he paints.
I know
he can do anything mechanical, can make stuff. They were all teachers. As soon as they finished secondary school. So all my aunts and uncles were teachers, so you knew they had a head for these things. And he seemed like a very industrious, like my entire family is exactly what you said. They were all industrious, hardworking people.
Hardworking is the adjective.
Grandfather had a shop, so it's like getting up and going to get milk in the hills and then coming back to work the shop before they even go to school. Things like that. So I'm going to have to stop here, but I want to hear more about that kind of stuff. And if you have some more time, some other day, I want to talk.
I am retired, so I am home all the time. When are you going back?
Next Thursday. Not this Thursday, but the August 3rd. August 3rd.
We got time, man.
So we got some time. I want to thank Mr. Frank Branch for giving me a couple hours of his day to talk about one of the things I'm most passionate about, which is the history of my town, Bowerly, St. Vincent, the history of St. Vincent in general, and trying to preserve that history in some way. Folks like Frank Branch are not going to be around forever, so I implore not just the people in my hometown, but anywhere in St. Vincent who feel strongly about where we want to go as a people in this new century. You can't go forward unless you understand some semblance of where you were and where you came from. I don't think history has ever been venerated on my island, and I don't think St. Vincent is alone. And so the phone, the telephone, the cell phone that I used to record Mr. Branch is nothing fancy. It's just a regular cell phone with a voice recording app. I pressed record and I sat down and I had a conversation with somebody. And now I'm preserving that conversation by posting it online. It's an easy thing to do. Anybody can do it. If you're unsure about questions to ask, reach out to me. There are resources I can point to you online. But this oral history is part of our Caribbean, part of our African tradition, part of our world tradition. And I think it's incredibly important that folks start getting back into it because we have the tools to make it so much easier to get the information and to record and preserve the information. So I hope that this is an example set for folks in Bowerly, folks in St. Vincent, folks in the Caribbean. Each of us have a voice, each of us has a story to tell, and it's incumbent on those who can to try to figure out ways of getting stories from maybe those who don't have the opportunity to tell theirs, and those who may not be around long enough to do it. So become an Ubuntu Radio partner in this. Record people over 50, 60, 70 years old. Sit down with them and have a conversation. Because in the end, I think you'll learn more than you think you will. And we, the listening audience, the community of folks who are interested in history, in the present, and figuring out ways of transferring knowledge into the future, we will all benefit from it. So I hope to see more of this. And when I go back to St. Vincent, I will certainly do more. To all my Bagavarians out there, the people on the Baga Me Come From page on Facebook, please, I've been asking all summer now, get a cell phone, get a recording app, and start recording the people in our town. It's important. Ubuntu Radio is out. See you next time.